Religion for Atheists. That's Alain de Botton's prescription for people who don't believe but may respect and miss experiences of faith. This cradle atheist is dissatisfied with popular dismissals of religion, and he's giving voice to a new way. He says that the most boring question you can ask of any religion is whether it is true. But how to live, how to die, what is good and what is bad, these are questions religion has sophisticated ways of addressing. And he feels that secular society has emptied public spaces of religious messaging only to fill them with commercial proselytizing that may impoverish us morally. And so Alain de Botton has created something called the School of Life, where people young and old explore ritual, community, beauty, and wisdom.
I fervently believe that in the next 100, 200 years, we will start to evolve ways of living a life where we don't believe that is much more sophisticated than the non-believing life we currently have on offer at the moment.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Alain de Botton is well known on both sides of the Atlantic for his previous books, How Proust Can Change Your Life, Status Anxiety, The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. A Swiss citizen at home in the UK, he's also something of a Renaissance man, a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and an honorary fellow of the Royal Institute of British Architects. He published his first novel, On Love, when he was only 23 in 1993. I interviewed him in 2012. Alain de Botton was born in Zurich of a wealthy banking family.
It's interesting to, you know, read you. You were raised, as you often say, in a devoutly atheist family. Is it right that your father was from an immigrant Jewish community in Egypt? Is that?
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. He was. And but my parents, we grew up in a very secular atmosphere, mm-hmm. Of a kind that, you know, very few people in history have enjoyed or had childhoods as secular as mine. It's a very modern phenomenon. I never went to a religious school. I didn't come across any, you know, religious education. There was no religion at home. Religion was happening very far away. It was just not within my sphere of reference. And I think they were rejecting what they saw as the traumas of religion,
right,
that had led the Jewish people to enormous suffering in the 20th century. And I think they were people who looked to a kind of secular modernity based around science and progress. They were, in a sense, very kind of, mid-20th century people who, right, who wanted an end to the bloodshed, the pain, the suffering that they saw religion as having caused, and wanted to move away from it all.
Right. And then you've written that in your mid-20s, you had what you called a crisis of faithlessness. Tell me about that.
Well, as I say, I grew up with this idea that religion was not only wrong, but also stupid, silly, ridiculous, something for other people. And then as I left home, started making my way in the world, I started discovering, and this was a slightly worrying discovery, that there were lots of things tangentially associated with religion that were quite nice. I rather liked religious architecture, something very beautiful about religious music. Many great works of art were religious in tone, and yet that didn't seem to stop me getting a lot from them. Right. So that's where my, as I say, crisis of faithlessness came about. I began to realize that religion, for all its flaws and for all its faults and all its excesses, had some high points that were incredibly interesting, fascinating, beautiful, inspiring. And it took me a while to square this with, you know, my atheism, the fact that I'm not a believer.
So the very first line of Religion for Atheists, I think, is a really important framing statement, and an unusual statement in the West, even though it's very simple, that the most boring and unproductive question one can ask of any religion is whether or not it is true.
That's right. You see, because it seems to me that most debates on religion currently center around the existence or non-existence of God. And I've sat in on many of these debates, and they are frankly boring, not because they're not touching on a very important issue. It is important. They're boring because no one ever makes any headway. Yeah. Because, you know, the atheists look at the religious and think that they're stupid, and the religious look at the atheist and think they're damned, and both sides are fiercely entrenched. The argument about whether God does or doesn't exist is, I think, ultimately one where most individuals are not rationally aware of their reasons for believing in what they believe.
Hmm.
You know, it's something
on
from
both
the heart.
Sides of the issue.
On both sides. Mm-hmm. On both sides. I think we grow into a position on religion. It's a little bit like our views of attraction. You know, we discover that we're attracted to certain people,
right.
Certain gender, certain types. We don't, sit down and think,
it's beyond rationality.
Exactly. It's slightly beyond rationality.
Mm-hmm.
And yet both sides insist that it is something they can convince through argument another person about. And I think this is simply not true.
And I mean, another important observation that you made, as you then began to, it seems to me, ponder and take seriously what you found, what you appreciated that religion had brought into the world. And it was art and architecture, but also concerns, practical skills for life, vocabulary. You also became aware or are aware that Christianity in particular, which is this dominant force in Western Europe and in the United States, had no qualms at its origins about co-opting the best of pagan society when it was creating its cultures.
That's right. There's a paradox that often people who don't particularly believe will sometimes be drawn to ideas or emotions or activities. And then they might say, that seems a bit too religious. And they might draw back from it.
Yeah.
Particularly, for example, the teaching of ethics or a moral code or even certain kinds of ritual. These things can seem to people who don't believe a little bit too religious. And then what's fascinating is if you look at the history of religions, of course, hoover up, they suck in all kinds of concepts and ideas.
From the culture around
originally,
them.
That's right, from mm-hmm. the culture around them. And religions have always done this. And so I suppose what I'm arguing for is a kind of reverse colonization. in the same way that Christianity colonized the pagan world, absorbing its best elements, so I'm arguing that non-believers today can do a little bit of this with religion, just as religion did it with them.
So, right.
You know, because a lot of what we find in Christianity comes, of course, from Greek philosophy. Even the concept of monasticism was taken from the Epicurean philosophical communities that existed in the Mediterranean world. So an awful lot that seems to us intrinsically religious is not. It's part of the treasury of mankind. These religions at their highest points, at their most complex and subtle moments, are far too interesting to be abandoned merely to those who believe in them.
Okay, so let's talk specifically about some of these aspects of religious tradition, religious communities that you feel are repositories of wisdom for, as you say, all of humanity, including non-believers. And, you know, you used the word moral just a second ago. And the phrase you use is of moral atmosphere, intentional moral atmospheres. You've said atheists overlook secular society's powerful and continuous calls to prayer.
Yes, I mean, I suppose what I'm arguing for is something quite simple, which is the importance of trying to be good and trying to be kind. Now, let me stress right away that I don't think religions have a monopoly on this at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's entirely possible to be good and kind and believe in nothing. I know this is a point that is extremely fraught in the United States, where atheists are regularly accused of being immoral. And I think that is absolutely wrong.
Yeah, I don't even know if the discussion gets that far, usually.
Right.
I mean, it may be an assumption. I don't think it's a very examined assumption.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, what religions do, which is rather interesting, is they recognize that we need to have constant public reminders of this, all this stuff about being good and kind that all of us probably sign up to in theory but forget about in practice. And this is a real contrast to the secular world, which basically says public space must be neutral. There must be no messages reaching people because that might be an infringement of freedom. To which I say, okay, that's all very well. But the point is, firstly, public space is not neutral. Because it's
there
dominated.
Are all kinds of messages reaching
it's dominated
us all
by
the
messages,
time. Yes.
Right, most of which are commercial messages.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, we don't live in the kind of completely neutral public space that's often fantasized about by secular defenders of a kind of neutral liberalism. We are actually as I say, assaulted by commercial messages. So religions want to assault us with other messages, mm-hmm. messages to be kind and to be good and to forgive and all these things. And they know that having a feeling of being observed, having a public space that is coloured by a moral atmosphere, that all of this can help. And I don't know, this intrigues and attracts me.
The idea that we are rational creatures or could become rational creatures living in a rationally run world was really a fundamental assumption that emerged in the, well, certainly in the course of the 20th century. a lot of evidence to the contrary, but it, you know, those of us, I think, who grew up in the latter part of the 20th century, there was this aspiration. And I mean, that is kind of a bedrock of secular society as we inherited it.
Yes, and I think along with that, you know, what's wrong with that? I think it's simply too mature. It's too reasonable. We're all a little bit crazier than that. And I think it's kind of cruel to deny this aspect. You find this a lot in education. You know, the modern secular education system is based on the idea that life is essentially a kind of fairly easy process to get through. And so you need to teach people certain skills for the modern economy, like accountancy and macrobiology and all this sort of stuff. But what you don't need to teach them is how to live, because mm-hmm. how to live is fairly obvious. All you need to do is, you know, separate yourself from your parents and bring up some children maybe and find a job you like. And
all those really easy things.
All those really easy things, and then, yeah. you know, and then confront your own death. And it's just really simple. So you don't need guidance.
Right.
And so you're supposed to know this stuff. And my question is, how? I don't know this stuff.
Right.
And the fascinating starting point of religions, all religions, is they start from the idea that we don't know how to live. And so that's why they need to teach us wisdom.
Right. I mean, you use words like religion's clear-eyed and unsentimental assessment of the human condition. And I have to say, as somebody who studied theology, I think this is an undervalued aspect of theology, I mean, Western culture in general, even among religious people, that there is this long tradition of deep thinking and wrestling with the complexity of the human condition, as much as is in there about the nature of God.
That's right. I mean, religions are sometimes mistaken for being very optimistic, almost mm-hmm. naive, childlike in their belief in our next world and everything being fine and God's providence and so on. But actually, you're absolutely right. If you look at religious tradition and history, there's many, many thinkers who are deeply clear-eyed, if not very pessimistic about
yes.
human nature in a way that strikes secular ears as a bit surprising, but I think actually a real relief, because sometimes the modern world is really optimistic. The view is, you know, everything can be perfected by science and technology, and we're soon going to be, you know, perfect creatures.
Yeah, I have to read. Here's these lines from your book, from Religion for Atheists. You talked about secular society, and it said that with no evident awareness of the contradictions, they may, in the same breath, gruffly dismiss a belief in angels while sincerely trusting in the combined powers of the IMF, the medical research establishment, Silicon Valley, and democratic politics could together cure the ills of mankind.
That's right. That's right. Whereas religions know, I mean, take the Catholic idea, and I speak as a convinced atheist, the Catholic idea of original sin, fascinating
right,
idea,
right.
beautiful idea, starts from the notion that the human animal is crooked. We are slightly wrong and imperfectible. The only perfectible creature out there is divine. That is the source of perfection. The human animal is a mixture of the divine and the not divine. And so, in other words, perfectibility is not in our nature, and we shouldn't aim for it. Now, this could seem a bit dark and pessimistic, but imagine trying to have a relationship with someone who thinks that perfectibility is within their grasp. Someone young, good-looking, very optimistic, who thinks, right. you know, I'm going to get together with another similarly perfect being, and we're going to have a fantastic, terrific time. I mean, watch out for the divorce lawyers and the alarm bells.
Right.
That's not going to work. Whereas if two people come together and go, look, I'm a little nuts, and, you know, you're probably a little nuts too, because, you know, you're human. But we're going to try and make a go of it. And, you know, against the deep backdrop of human fallibility, I'd give that relationship much more of a vote, because it's going to be based on reality.
Well, and even to bring this to another level, like, I couldn't help thinking as I was reading you about the economic crisis we're in, both in Europe and the United States, where we had we had lived with this vision of eternal progress, this upward arc that would never end. But what economists now, this supposedly rational discipline, right? We turned it into a rational discipline. What they hadn't factored in and are now factoring in is fickleness and flaws and weakness of human nature.
That's right. That's right. And so a little kind of stoic realism can be very, very helpful. Also, you know, talking about economic crisis, the other thing that religions have done fascinatingly throughout their history is to make a distinction between earthly power and virtue. In other words, you can be very rich and very powerful,
right?
But your heart may not be good.
That those are two different strivings and pieces
absolutely
of work.
You know, we have an echo of it when we ask of people, you know, if somebody says, you know, so-and-so is really, you know, rich and successful. That second question we might ask is, but are they nice? Now, that's a Christian question, but in its origins in the West, I would argue. In other words, that there is a distinction between power and goodness. And the fact that we have such a distinction still in our culture is down to religion, which is, now you don't have to believe in heaven to know that that's a very good distinction to have in your culture. It gives people a capacity to be so-called successful on different registers, and that provides huge mental breathing space, especially at times like these.
Yes, and there are different scales for defining a life of dignity.
Exactly, exactly.
And I mean, it's interesting, if a couple of other things that you, features of, very religious features of traditions that you also say that atheists and secular society could learn from, something like the Day of Atonement in Judaism, or the saints, the tradition of saints in Roman Catholicism.
Yes, I mean, taking those two, the Day of Atonement, a fascinating moment in the calendar in Judaism where people essentially say sorry to each other, and they say sorry against the backdrop of a God who doesn't make mistakes, but humans who do. And you are given license, encouragement, structure to do something which would be mightily hard if you were left to do it on your own. Like, as I say, saying sorry. It's much easier to say sorry if everybody's doing it on a particular day, because then there's a sort of cycle of mutual apology and forgiveness, right, which makes the whole thing much more normal. You know, we're very suspicious of ritual in the non-believing world. We, you know, we think that there shouldn't really be rituals, that private life should have its own rhythms, and that no one should come in from the outside and say, you know, well, today we're going to say sorry, and, you know, next week we're going to worship spring, and the day after, you know, we're going to think about the qualities of humility in a saint or something. The idea is you should do all this on your own, in private. And I'm coming round to the view that, you know, that's nice in theory, the problem is we'll never get round to it.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, a religion for atheists. Alain de Botton has written a book with that title, and he founded the School of Life in 2008. It's part community, part educational center. People of all ages sign up and pay to be part of weekday and Sunday meetings, complete with music and secular sermons on meaning and wisdom for modern lives. So, interestingly, you have created an organization, a community, I think you would say, this School of Life.
That's right.
Right, where you are actually putting some of this into effect. But I don't know that much about how it works. I mean, I've looked at the website, but so I'd like to hear about what happens there, who comes, and how does it function?
Well, this thing called the School of Life does pick up on a number of ideas that I had. First of all, it picks up on the idea that we need guidance, that learning how to live is not something we just do spontaneously. Where do we turn to? There are actually surprisingly not that many places. So the idea came to me to start an institution. It's very little, but it's having a sort of big, strangely big impact, even though it's quite tiny.
It's in London?
It's in London, center of London, and anyone who comes by London can just drop in at any time. And every evening, we've got classes in the great challenges of life, mortality, children, divorce, marriage, money, poverty, success, all the things that are likely to trouble people, we discuss in communal settings, it's both academically rigorous but very human. And people meet each other. Mm. We introduce people to each other. So that's what the school does. We introduce people and we talk about these great problems. And one of the things that this is about is organizing oneself, because religions are, we say, organized. They are organized religions. In other words, they're groups of people who get together and go, look, we're not going to be able to do it all on our own. We're going to get into a team. And that way, you know, what we have to say will get a little bit more traction.
So, you know, I read a journalist's account of coming to the School of Life, and it was really interesting. They described it as a place of play and whimsy and big talk, that it's warm and stylish and serious. I mean, I have to say, I watched a bit online and I watched a sermon that you gave, and that is a word to use, that some of these talks are called sermons. And the video I watched, there were a lot of people there that looked like people of all ages, and a lot of young people, and they were singing Jerusalem, this yeah. great classic hymn, which is at once deeply Christian and deeply British.
Thank you, Gaggle. After that, we'll be ready to go anywhere and do anything. That's the power of music. It motivates us. It changes us. It makes us ready for change. One could say, what on earth is going on?
Exactly.
But of course, you know, when you talk to people who don't believe, one of the things they often say is, such a pity, because the music's fantastic and the singing is, you know, is great. And, you know, I love to have the cup of tea at the end, you know, and chat to neighbours and all the rest of it. That's what people love, often more than the actual liturgy. To which my response is, OK, well, look, if you like all this stuff, let's have some of this stuff in our lives. So we've had terrific success by hosting what we're calling secular sermons. Now, why are we calling them sermons? It's to try and suggest that listening to them is not simply going to be, you know, an intellectual exercise, you know, fascinating little bit of knowledge, a way to show off to friends about new stuff you've learned. It's actually going to be something that will hope to steer how you live. And so it's didactic. It's, you know, it's explicitly kind of moralistic, not in a kind of starched Victorian way, but in the best possible sense. It exhorts you to a kind of better, fuller life. And, you know, why not? Why should these really quite nice manoeuvres only be the preserve of religion? You know, as I say, they really are for all of us.
In your writing, you also often pull out pieces of liturgy, I mean, words that are explicitly religious. And the Book of Common Prayer in Britain is also a beautiful example of taking religious ideas and turning them into beautiful language. So, you know, you wrote, "Strangers gaze up at the vaulted, star-studded ceiling, rehearse in union the words, 'Lord, come live in your people and strengthen them by your grace.'" So, I mean, even words like that, do you feel that those have a meaning for secular people, and that you feel that you retain your intellectual integrity by offering
them? Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I proceed as a kind of anthropologist or a psychologist, and my immediate thought is, okay, what's going on here? Why is this quite nice? Why is this kind of sonorous, ancient language rather nice? I think a lot of what's attractive in religion is that it puts us in a wider perspective, both in time and in place, because most of our lives are lived right up against the present moment. We get so stressed, we get so you know, confused, we get so overwhelmed by the kind of people around us, what's in our diaries, what's going on right now. And then once a week or more or less, you can go to a religious institution, be it a, you know, a mosque, a synagogue, a church, and you can step outside of the ordinary, and you can be brought into contact with very, very old things, or very vast things, things that are much greater, deeper, more mysterious than ordinary life. And suddenly that brings a kind of calm to our kind of inner lives, because, well, it's nice to be made to feel small, you know, against the backdrop of a vast universe.
You're part of something larger than yourself.
Exactly. That's why, you know, the average cathedral works really well, even if you don't believe in any of the liturgy, because what's happening in that space is that, you know, your eyes rise up to the ceiling and you think, oh, I'm a tiny thing in this vast, rather beautiful, rather fascinating, mysterious universe. And suddenly, you know, the argument you were having with X or Y seems, you know, no longer so significant.
You, as you said, have an unusually pure trajectory as somebody who's raised with no religion. So, and you've never been a traditionally religious person even for a little while. So you've never had the precise experience that a religious person has in that kind of community and worship. But I do suspect that some would argue that even with all these component parts that we've identified in others that make religion work and powerful, that still believers would feel that there is this transcendent cohesive force that is larger than the sum of all of those qualities. How do you respond to that, or how, you know, how do you think about that?
Well, you know, some people have said, look, it's all very well, you know, you're looking at all these different sides of religion, you're picking a bit from here and a bit from there, but the point is, if you're a religious person, you can't simply do this because it's all secondary to something much larger, which is a belief in a particular God and in a particular, you know, vision of divinity. To which I can only say, look, I am an atheist. In other words, I've not had this feeling. I don't know what this feeling is. I'm, you know, it's just not working for me. I can't see it, can't feel it. All I can report is that many of these bits of religion do impact me greatly. I don't know what it would be like to be part of a community and actually believe, or to look at religious art and actually believe in it, etc. All I can report is that as a non-believer, these things are pretty powerful as well, which has upset certain religious people who will say things like, how can you say that, you know, you really like the frescoes of Giotto, but you're leaving the resurrection aside, or that you love, you know, St. Augustine's vision of the city of God, but that, you know, you're going to leave aside
God,
you know, the Trinity. Yeah,
right.
You're going to leave aside the Trinity or something. You know, and, you know, to which I would say, I think it is possible. I can understand that it would seem insulting to a believer. I don't mean to be insulting in any way. But I mean, if I was different, I would be a believer, is all I can say. I can only speak from a non-believing position.
Here's neuroscientist David Eagleman speaking about consciousness and decision-making at Alain de Botton's School of Life in London.
And I think the thing for all of us to think about all the time is, how are we lashing ourselves to the mast? We all have weaknesses and things that we want to do better. And as we come to understand more about ourselves, there's this issue of what can we do to combat this? How can we really think hard about structuring things in our lives so we don't do the wrong things? And I think this gives us traction. You know, understanding what's going on under the hood gives us traction on old philosophical problems and ways to think about things. Just think about the concept of virtue. I think that virtue has to do with the battles between these populations. If you've got a real drive to do something, you want it so badly, and yet you override that with more long-term decision-making, with the parts of your brain that care about the deferred gratification versus the parts that care about, I want it right now. If you have that battle and you're successful, I think that's what we mean by a virtuous person. I think virtue comes at people's point of struggle, right when the parliament is sort of evenly balanced and they have a real decision to make there about which way it tips.
Watch more secular sermons on our website, or download an MP3 of this show and share it with others. All that at onbeing.org. Coming up, Alain de Botton's hopes for the future evolution of atheism. I'm Krista Tippett. On Being continues in a moment. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, Religion for Atheists. That's the title of a book by my guest, philosophical writer Alain de Botton. He created the School of Life in London, where people young and old explore ritual, community, beauty, and wisdom.
He says that keeping these things is what religion has done best, but they should be part of the common richness of humanity, not just for believers. So I remember a conversation I had years ago with one of the greatest 20th century religious historians, Yaroslav Pelikan at Yale. And in his 80s, he completed his last project, which was a survey of creeds, Christian creeds, across time, across the world. And he believed very strongly, I'll just say it, you know, the blunt way he said it was that the only alternative to tradition is bad tradition. And he pointed out that when people reject the creeds, but want to believe something and do believe something, that they still end up then ultimately creating new creeds, and that's always something that's going to happen. Do you think about this? If you had the school of life long enough, would you eventually end up with something like doctrines and creeds?
Look, I think doctrines are evolving all the time. We almost don't see it, but these things are changing and being enriched, and they're subject to evolution. And I do believe that the Earth is still young. Humanity is still very, very young. We sort of think sometimes, oh, we've been around for ages, we've tried everything, we're at the end of time. No, we're still very much at the beginning. We're still working out how to live. You know, we haven't taken our first steps almost. And I think we're at a particular point in history where we can see that a lot more is going to come in the future. I fervently believe that in the next 100, 200 years, we will start to evolve ways of living a life where we don't believe, a non-believing life that is much more sophisticated than the non-believing life we currently have on offer at the moment. At the moment, we're offering people either the choice of, look, either you sign up to one of these religions with all their doctrines and all their sometimes rather arduous demands on us, or you're outside, you know, and outside is really outside. And, you know, take something like dying and marrying. You know, in the secular world, we're having great difficulty knowing how to be married and how to die outside of religions. You know, when people get married or die, they overwhelmingly flock back to religion because these religions know how to do it.
And it's still now, often a point on the trajectory, but just a very tiny point.
Yeah, very brief one, but it's significant. And, you know, my view is this is just that we haven't sorted this problem out yet. It doesn't have to be the case. You know, it's very possible that non-believers will learn how to do dying slightly better. We've done amazingly at the medical front, but on the more human front, we're beginners. We don't really know how to do this. And similarly with relationships. You know, we praise romantic love and relationships to the skies, but do we really know how to make these things work? Not really. Mm-hmm. So a lot lies before us. And oddly, I think it's the study of the creativity of religions in addressing human needs that should be inspiring us, not just to look backwards, but also to look forwards for how much still needs to be done.
So I often make a statement, which I think is somewhat controversial, that I think you know, atheists have spiritual lives too. I mean, then it ends up depending on how you're defining spiritual, but would you say it that way? Do atheists have spiritual lives?
Of course. I mean,
Do you have a spiritual life?
Yes. I mean, it's like the word soul, you know. Mm-hmm. Do atheists have souls? In a strict religious sense, no. But in the loose sense, yes. And we all know what we mean. If you meet somebody and you say, you know, that person, he was quite interesting, but he seemed to lack soul. She doesn't seem to
have
much soul.
We have secular ways of using this word.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. But I think when we use it that way, we're onto something rather useful. It means an allusion to the deeper sides of a human being, the side that's going to confront death, the side that's there at moments of love, the side that is interested in questions of kind of ultimate meaning and direction, the serious stuff, you know, the side of us that kind of we confront at 3 a.m. when we're awoken and suddenly the world seems, you know, a challenging place to deal with in the way that sometimes we might not notice in the kind of busyness of the day. I think that's the soul bit. And of course it exists in non-believers as much as in believers. And similarly, you know, atheists have amazing moments under the stars as well. When atheists look up and see the galaxies and contemplate the sheer nothingness, puniness of humans in the cosmos, it's just how we choose to interpret it. We don't leap to a supernatural conclusion.
Right.
So when I look at the cosmos, I'm not forced to then make the next step, which is to say there must be something out there. But look, there's so much more in common between believers and non-believers than we're sometimes encouraged to think.
Yes.
At the very last moment under the stars, we may differ about, you know, what's going on, but we can still have, you know, a very nice time together for a long, long part of this journey.
And your book is doing well. I mean, you are a very popular writer. You have a big following. But a book like this, Religion for Atheists, does not make a splash in the way a book called The God Delusion makes a splash. Or, on the other end, you know, some very religious books make a splash. I think you're on to something in terms of there being a kind of renaissance of searching for depth and meaning and thinking. But how do you explain this? You know, the fact that, you know, you're touching the pulse of something, and yet in some of these ways we measure what's important, what is in fact hitting chords. There's a disconnect. How do you think about that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was an enormous phenomenon in the UK and in Australia, and indeed in Canada too. In the US, slightly less. In the UK, the debate was, oh, look, here's an atheist who doesn't think religion is absolutely ridiculous.
Right.
Headline. I mean,
okay.
An extraordinary thing.
Yes.
Which is, that's a sign of how peculiar. And of course, the media aligned me with Richard Dawkins and tried to make sure we had some kind of a fight.
Yes.
Look, I think we are in very divided times. And if you come out with a book like mine, you get shot at from both sides. The religious people say, hang on a minute, you know, he's impious. And the non-believers, I mean, I've had emails from atheists saying things like, you've betrayed atheism.
Mm-hmm.
And I email back going, well, I'm not sure what that means.
Right.
And they say, well, you've been far too kind to religion. And I say, I didn't know that's what atheism was supposed to be about, being mean to religion.
Okay.
You know, and you get this odd kind of dialogue. So, yeah, divided times.
You said something like this a minute ago, that we've had much too narrow an understanding of what it means to be non-religious, and that the words, I think, atheist and agnostic, in some ways are boxes, just like a lot of religious labels have been boxes, and people are breaking out of those. I mean, but isn't atheism as an absolute conviction as intellectually presumptuous and unprovable as faith as an absolute conviction? I mean, are you ever tempted to convert to agnosticism?
I think the moment that I feel like it, I would. In other words, I'm not clenched to this position at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that I really don't feel a belief in a divine being is something that I'm, you know, that rings bells with me. So, look, I'm happy to be in that in the atheist box, but it's a much broader box than we might have allowed for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's an image of the fierce atheist who has faith in science and ridicules all religious moments and religious impulses. And as I say, you know, I couldn't be further from that point of view. Look, it's ultimately, I think we do need to stretch categories. One of the people I discuss in my book is this rather crazy French sociologist called Auguste Comte,
right,
who in the 19th century analyzed modern society and argued that if we simply create a society that's based around financial accumulation and success on the one hand, and private life, family, relationships on the other, we're going to have an outbreak of mental illness. He diagnosed this, I think, rather provocatively and accurately in many ways, that humans need to live for something more than just themselves. And religion has been a way of channeling that. Now, Kant's response to that was to create what he called a secular religion, an atheist's religion. He called it the religion for humanity. And it was basically a stripped-down secular version of Catholicism with his girlfriend Mathilde in the position of the Virgin Mary. Kind of nuts in many ways, but sort of interesting in all its looniness. So he was very eccentric, but there's something there about stretching what it means to be an atheist, recognizing that modern society hasn't got all the answers, being creative in relation to the needs of, you know, the inner being, the spiritual being, the soul. You know, there's food for thought there.
Mm-hmm. So I think that this diagnosis you make of belief uncoupled from virtues as something that hasn't served secular society, hasn't served non-religious people, it's also a gap that's been there in religious people, you know? I mean, I've watched religion re-enter politics in the United States in a new way in the last few decades, but it was all about beliefs and opinions and not necessarily about how one treated enemies, for example, which would be a primary virtue of Christianity.
Yes, you absolutely. Know?
And so I think the way you're thinking about this critique could also be very useful for religious people.
Yes, of course, absolutely. I mean, many religious people, many nominally religious people, have slightly forgotten what good religion is supposed to be about. And in fact, many of the readers of my book who've been most sort of appreciative of it have said to me, oh, thank you for reminding me as a believer of what the best bits of our religions are. Because, of course, as you rightly point out, there's so many ways to be religious, and many of the most public ways of being religious that we're seeing at the moment are perhaps not optimal, particularly in their intolerance. And, of course, tolerance is right at the heart of many religions. And tolerance does not mean agreeing with people. Sometimes it's mistaken. Sometimes we believe that the tolerant person learns to agree or to see the other person's point of view. No. What tolerance really means is, even though you don't get what the other person's saying at all, even though you may not even like them, you make an effort to tolerate, in other words, to make space for them, and you don't try and squash their opinions. What we need to learn is, how can we live together with people whose views we don't actually like very much? That's the far greater challenge, without attempting to convert them or dismissing them and denying their right to exist parallel to us. It's really about the stranger. And particularly Christianity's had a lot of time for the stranger.
Yes.
The stranger that you welcome into the home, even though that their beliefs may not be yours, because they too, wherever they come from, they too were made by God. Now, even if you don't believe that they were made by God, there's some very important lesson in there. It's basically saying we have a shared humanity, even with people who don't seem to tick the boxes that we have put in place in terms of recognizing what a good human is.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, Religion for Atheists, with author, philosopher, and School of Life founder Alain de Botton. Do you ever think about what your father would think, the devout atheist, would think about this line of thinking, the school of life?
He'd think his poor son had gone very soft in the head.
Okay, really?
And he'd think it was all, buck up, young man, and this is all soft stuff. It's with the fairies, really. I respected him, and that was his point of view. But every generation can work things out on their own.
Mm-hmm. I do feel that another religious and particularly Christian impulse that you are taking up as an atheist is that of being evangelical, right? Which is about spreading the good news that you've discovered.
That's interesting. Of course, what Christianity, all religions to some extent, are very interested in is rhetoric, convincing people through oratory, through speaking, through trying to discuss things. And we've slightly lost that. I mean, certainly the field that I come from intellectually, philosophy, now mumbles its truths to the world and therefore doesn't really have an audience. And even though I often don't agree with the content of what the sermonizing tradition is saying in religions, the fact that they're out there speaking well, mobilizing people, of course, this is a fascinating project. I do believe in trying to reach people, reach an audience. One of the ways in which I try to do this is to try and be very clear, lay my ideas out sort of succinctly. And
it's not just your ideas, though. It's your passion, too.
I don't know. I think if you believe in stuff, you want to tell people about it. But I hope I remain open to other people and other ideas. And I think that's it should always be a two-way process. By all means, get out there and spread your news, but be aware that others might have other interesting news and be open to that.
I just want to say you're in an interesting position to be having this message to be carrying these ideas as someone who's British, where you have a state church which everyone belongs to but few actively believe in these days. And yet I think it's possible to argue that some of the virtues of religion, of care for the stranger and the poor, got taken up in laws and in social norms, even as the culture became more secular.
Yes, I mean, it's true that the UK is incredibly secular. I mean, it's much more secular than the US. I think I partly wrote this book because the Church of England, the dominant Christian denomination, is so on its knees. They're very gentle souls who generally will have anyone who believes anything. I mean, church attendance is so low. Mm-hmm. They've lost so many. They're sort of figures of fun. This is Monty Python or the Life of Brian country,
right.
Where religion really is a kind of comedic thing. In a way that might be hard for Americans to understand. But you also rightly point out that many religious attitudes are kind of embedded in day-to-day life and in structures like the National Health Service, yes. which is basically a Christian institution. No one ever mentions it.
Yeah.
But the national provision of healthcare has deeply, deeply religious roots and in ways that the secular world kind of doesn't dare mention, but of course it does.
Right, right. And, as you create this school of life, that's the landscape in which you are still saying these virtues do need to mean something in lives. And people living today want these things to be part of their lives. But we need structures and rituals and we need to help each other in that and take a cue from how religion has known to do that.
That's right. I think too often, when we decide, when we feel, I don't believe, that can often mean a complete withdrawal from participation in, interest in, even knowledge of religion. I think this is a tremendous mistake and impoverishes us intellectually, if you like, spiritually, practically, because there's so much there that we can be inspired by, guided by. We understand ourselves better, even as atheists, by understanding what religious people have felt a need to address in their lives. The secular world has still got many, many needs. We sometimes think we've invented everything. We haven't. There's as much invention to do in the kind of soul space as there is in the technological space. And we need to be creative. And one of the ways in which we're going to be creative is by being fully aware of the constant creativity that religions have shown in addressing these very strange, slightly hard to discuss needs that we might call the needs of the soul, but that are there and they greet us at 3 a.m. or in relationships when we hit difficulties or when we're facing mortality or just when we're out and about under the stars. We feel these needs and we need to address them. We need to find a structure for them.
Yeah, and soul space. What I also see you doing is carving out what has been traditionally religiously called sacred space in secular culture. And you talk about that even literally in terms of architecture as well as these spaces of gathering and reflection.
That's right. There's, the things that have been demarcated by that term sacred space are, again, belong to everybody, not just believers. They're the common richness of all of us. And even religious buildings, the wonders of religious architecture. How come we've forgotten all of that?
Right.
How come modern architects don't know that good architecture is part of being a good human being?
Well, and the impulse that we are formed by the spaces we're in, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And similarly, evil, one route through which evil reaches us is through ugliness and a fascinating, provocative kind of idea. Imagine putting that to the average property developer.
Yeah.
So again, it's just yet another example of how religions continuously provoke and challenge routine assumptions of the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I mean, I think what I really care about and have cared across my career as a writer is getting what you might broadly, and I don't mean this pretentiously, but let's use it that word anyway, wisdom higher up on the agenda. The art of living, how to cope with life in its all its complexities. That's really what drives me, and it's a kind of life's mission.
Alain de Botton is the founder and chairman of the School of Life in London. His books include Religion for Atheists and How Proust Can Change Your Life. Listen to my unedited interview with Alain de Botton on our website, onbeing.org. On Facebook, we're at facebook.com/onbeing. On Twitter, you can follow our show at beingtweets. And the best way to stay on top of everything we do is through our weekly email newsletter. Subscribing is fast and it's easy. Just click the newsletter link on any page at onbeing.org. On Being is produced on air and online by Chris Heagle, Lily Percy, and Stephanie Bell. Our intern is Megan Bender. Trent Gillis is senior editor.
On Being is a Krista Tippett public production, distributed by American Public Media, and is supported by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. On Being is extending its reach throughout America with support from Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private foundation.
Next time, a frank, public conversation with leaders in finance on ethics and the future. Analyst Meredith Whitney, investment banker and generosity network creator Jeffrey Walker, and former Barclays CEO Bob Diamond. Please join us.